This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 86.
Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, Angie will tell you how to prepare for a marathon with long downhill sections, some very important lessons she learned at her latest race, the Deseret News Classic Marathon in Salt Lake City. And for this episode's quick tip, you'll find out what to do with your running shoes after they get soaking wet. And to train with us for your next marathon or half marathon, find out how to become a member of the Academy by visiting our website, marathontrainingacademy.com. So, Angie, how was yoga today?
It was good.
In spite of our son throwing up on the way?
Yeah, I got there about 15 minutes late after that mini crisis.
Yeah, we got halfway there. A little guy threw up. We came back to get him cleaned up, and then I bailed. I'm like, I'm not going. Sorry, coffee and a book was just calling me in a quiet house.
Yes, those are all good things. I know, I kind of got there and I thought, what am I doing here? I already did Insanity this morning. My arms are tired.
Oh, did you?
You know, it's all good. Yes, I'm on week two of Insanity, so.
Well, what is Insanity, for those that might not know?
Insanity is similar to the P90X workouts. It's by the Beachbody company. It's high-intensity interval training, so you do approximately 3 minutes of high-intensity training, and then you get like a short 30-second break, and then you go back into it. Basically, I sweat so much that my kids just like watching me doing it to see how much I'm sweating. Like, Mom, there's sweat dripping off your nose.
Wow.
So yeah, it's been a fun new challenge. A little bit difficult to fit with a running routine because it's high impact. And so, you know, it's not like I really feel like doing a run and Insanity back to back. But I've had some people, you know, over the years ask me about cross training using Insanity. So I figured, well, I might as well try it out.
What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a great workout. As far as how it will pay off in terms of running fitness and injury prevention, you know, we'll have to see. Yeah. I'm the guinea pig, but I know a lot of people have had really good success with it. One of my good friends does Insanity a lot, and she's a very fast runner, so maybe the two go hand in hand, I'm hoping.
We just returned from a 3-week, 5,000-mile trip across 8 states. While we were out there, we were at 2 marathons, the Missoula Marathon, which we talked about in our last episode, and then later, sort of on the spur of the moment, we went to the Deseret News Classic Marathon in Salt Lake City, which Angie was able to run, and we'll talk about that a little bit. It'll go along with this episode's topic, training for running downhill. Well, before we get into this episode's topic, we have some inspiring shout-outs that we want to make from people in our academy who are doing some great things.
That's right. A few of these are snippets that have been posted on Facebook. Jerry from Michigan said, I just ran a 5K in 33 minutes and 24 seconds. I cut almost 4 minutes off my last one. So I thought that was a pretty cool accomplishment. 4 minutes off the 5K is a very good PR.
Yeah.
Mary from New York says, for the first time in my running life, I tried to PR in a race. I've always been afraid to try that for fear of disappointment. But I ran a 5K yesterday in 32 minutes, 15 seconds, which is my fastest time to date. My goal of a sub-30 suddenly seems attainable. I also ran my fastest mile to date as well, 9 minutes and 44 seconds. It's all starting to come together.
Yeah, it is an awesome feeling when you see your times getting faster. Not just your marathon times, but your times on your miles or smaller races like 5Ks. It's a great feeling.
That's right. And often people find that when they're training for longer distance, it also pays off in their shorter speed. Here's another message from Chris in Pennsylvania, and he's also talking about a recent 5K that he PR'd at. He said, I ran 6 miles to the start of the 5K this morning as a warm-up, then ran the 5K and PR'd by almost 3 minutes. Former PR was 22 minutes, 29 seconds. His new PR is 19 minutes and 40 seconds. He says, I was pumped to finish so good and definitely couldn't do any of my recent success without the help of Angie. She's an amazing coach. That sounds rather self-promoting to read that.
I would have to concur with Chris that you are an amazing coach.
Thank you. I actually was congratulating another of my coaching clients on some great speed work she did this week, and she said, I'm the painting and you are the painter. I thought it was kind of funny.
No, it is on these people. I mean, they are taking action.
Exactly. That's right. I mean, I can't run any of the miles for them. They're doing it all. So it's really exciting to be part of that success.
Yeah, I mean, they're just inspiring, driven people who are taking action. That's what matters, I think.
That's right. I also wanted to give an update from John. People may remember back in our bonking and cramping episode.
Yeah.
He was the one who had the pretty much full body cramp going on during his marathon.
His forearms cramped.
Yes, his forearms cramped. I know a lot of people could relate to the agony he was going through. And so I wanted to read an update from him. And he says, Angie, after my first marathon 2 months ago, I wrote to you with my race report and my accounts of cramping at the 20-mile mark. As I carried a calf injury into my second marathon, I was unable to really test out the strategies that you recommended on your recent show with Trevor, where you discussed bonking and cramping. However, last weekend, I ran my perfect marathon distance race in 3 hours and 41 minutes. I am pleased to advise you that I did a negative split of the course. I had no cramping, no bonking. My fueling and hydration plan worked perfectly, and I finished really strong. Just wanted to say thanks, as your support and advice allowed me to smash my 3:45 time goal, and I feel confident that I can do a 3:30 marathon in this calendar year. By the way, Sunday's race also qualified me to become a marathon maniac, and my bright yellow singlet is in the mail. Thanks again, and I'll look for my fellow asylum inmates when I come into the States later this year. And John is from Sydney, Australia.
Wow, that's a great report. Solving that mystery and getting around that hurdle of bonking and crapping, so it can be done.
Exactly. You don't have to suffer forever in most cases.
And if you have a really difficult marathon, like maybe it's your first one and there's really a lot of discomfort, don't give up on this whole idea of becoming a marathoner.
Exactly. I mean, we all have bad races or subpar races every now and then. But, you know, just keep moving forward. And sometimes the worst long runs or the worst races really end up teaching you so much, and they're more valuable in the long run.
Yeah.
Playing words there. Than, you know, the perfect scenario. So just learn and go on.
Well, before we get into how to tackle the downhills, Angie, let me ask you, are you glad to be back home after being gone for 3 weeks?
Yes, I am. It's just nice to be in your own space and your own routine again.
Right.
Although, you know, I do miss parts of vacation, like not having to cook, not having to clean, you know, seeing beautiful mountains and, yeah, stuff like that. But, yeah, it is nice to get back to what we're supposed to be doing. And
what are we supposed to be doing?
I don't know. The podcast, I guess.
We just figure that one out and let me know, and I will be so grateful.
You want a honey-do list? Is that it? Well on my way, well on my way, well on my way.
Okay, we're going to talk about how to tackle hills, and we're going to put this in the context of a story, because Angie just recently ran the Deseret News Classic Marathon in Salt Lake City. So what was that like, and how do we prepare ourselves for running an extreme distance downhill?
I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. I guess I should point out that I didn't prepare to run massive downhills. In fact, this marathon came 10 days after the Missoula Marathon, and as we were planning our return trip home, you came across this race and said, hey, you want to run this marathon in Utah?
Because we're going to drive through Utah anyway.
Right, and so obviously I can't say no to a marathon, especially one in a new state.
And it was on a Wednesday. I mean, how convenient is that? That's awesome.
Yeah, I've never run a marathon on a Wednesday before. So it was awesome, you know, a lot of new things, new state, new day of the week. Yeah, it was just an awesome opportunity. So we headed over to Utah, and this marathon is billed as the oldest marathon west of the Continental Divide, and it's supposedly the oldest road race in Utah, and it was the 43rd time it was taking place, and it's actually on Pioneer Day every year in July. And this year they had a half marathon, and there's also a 10K. Like I mentioned earlier, it did start at altitude. The full marathon was at 7,900 feet for the start, and then it finished downtown Salt Lake City, which I think is around 4,400 feet elevation. And the marathon course basically follows the path the pioneers took when they first settled the valley. So this was going to be a chance for me to apply all the wonderful information I gave you on the last episode about running a marathon at elevation.
Yeah.
Without actually preparing for it. So anyway, we found our hotel in Salt Lake, and the marathon buses ran between 3:15 and 3:30 a.m.
That is insane.
So yes, the race started at 5:30 a.m., and even though I'm a morning person, the idea of waking up at 2 a.m. is not really thrilling. But
how do you even sleep if you know you got to get up at 2 a.m.?
Right, that's part of it. You just kind of like doze and like look at your clock and dread the fact that you have to get up, that kind of thing. So we kind of, you know, figure out the logistics a little bit, got my race packet, and the kids were hungry and cranky. So we ended up getting some pizza to take back to our hotel room, and it turned out to be the worst pizza in the history of the world, as I'm dubbing it. I'm not like highly picky with food. I like food, but I'm not extremely picky. And I couldn't even finish one slice of it. It was just black.
So, it was like cardboard.
It was horrible. Anyway, so I'm not trying to be some kind of diva, you know, since I've done all these marathons. I don't want to be like, everything has to be perfect. So we kind of rolled with it. But
right.
I think I had an energy bar for dinner.
But it wasn't your idea of the perfect pre-race meal.
Right, exactly. So I can now blame anything that goes wrong the next day on that horrible pizza. That's how it ends up.
Sounds good.
Anyway, I was laying out all my race gear that night and put my Garmin on to charge. All the good stuff that you do so you're organized in the morning when your brain is not working and you don't want to wake your family up. And so I think I got around 5 hours of sleep. And got all my stuff together and grabbed my watch to put it on, and I noticed it was completely dead.
Wow.
Like non-responsive, blank, etc. And it's happened to me once before, and I had a couple tricks up my sleeve that I used to try to restart it, but this time it was not responding. It would come on if I had it plugged into the charger, but it wasn't really holding a charge. So I was like, oh, man. But, you know, I'm experienced in this marathon business, so I figured I can do a race without my Garmin. You know, I'll just work on evening up my wrist tan.
I mean, you could have taken mine.
Right, but that would have involved rummaging through your suitcase, asking you where it was, realizing your watch was dead, and not even how to work the watch in the first place because I'm not, like, skilled at new technology. So,
did I just say token?
Probably.
For the record, though, I know that was bad grammar, and I retract it.
Thank you. So I drove myself to the bus pickup area at the stadium and got on the bus with a bunch of other sleepy strangers at the ungodly hour of the morning. And a woman soon sat by me from the area, and we kind of started talking running, marathons, family, you know, all that good stuff. And she had just run Boston this year and also the Salt Lake City Marathon earlier in the spring.
So the Salt Lake City Marathon is different than the Deseret News Classic.
Exactly. I think
Salt Lake City has two marathons.
It actually has three. I think there's one in the fall she was telling me about.
Okay.
But it, you know, it's maybe called something different. But yeah, the area does have a lot to offer as far as marathons. And so she had done the Deseret Classic Marathon before. I think this was her third time. And so I kind of like started pumping her for details about the race, because when I read on Marathon Guide, some of the descriptions were kind of negative, like, you know, mm-hmm. It was unorganized, the course was hard to follow, etc. So I tried to get all the information out of her, and she basically just said, hold back on the first 6 miles of the race because it's all downhill, and then prepare for the killer hills between miles 6 and 8. So I was like, oh, I can hold back, I'm good with that. About this time, our bus driver takes a wrong turn on this mountain road. So she has to do this scary 12-point turn to back and turn the bus around without plunging us into the canyon below.
So, oh, man.
Fortunately, it was dark, so I couldn't see all the way down in the canyon, but I think my life flashed before my eyes. Anyway.
This is like 2 in the morning.
This is maybe 3:45 in the morning. So we arrived at Parley's Canyon, where the starting line was. This is in the Wasatch Mountain Range. And it was nice up on top. It wasn't as cold as I expected. I'd come prepared with a long sleeve shirt and a blanket to sit on because people had said, oh, it's freezing cold at the top. But I thought it was really, you know, pretty well organized. They had a lot of porta pots up there. They had kind of a big tent that a lot of runners were sitting under, and, you know, water, and you could get your gear bag set up and things like that. So I just kind of, you know, sat around, talked to some people, and kind of wished I was back in bed. It was dark up there, and you could tell it was just a really beautiful area. We just really couldn't see much, so.
Mm-hmm. So did you bring a flashlight?
I did not, no. And so when we got in the porta-pot, it was, like, completely dark, like, But.
But thankfully you have years of experience.
Of going to the bathroom in the dark, so yeah, it was fine.
How long did you have to wait once you got there till the start?
Yeah, that was the other thing. We waited for an hour and a half.
In the cold, dark on the mountain.
Yes, in the semi-cold, I should say. You know, it wasn't like bone-chilling cold or anything.
What is the logic to that?
Well, I guess the logic is to get all of the runners to the top and get things organized so that There are no last-minute snafus. Which, actually, one guy got to the buses, realized he forgot his bib and shit back at the house. So by that time, the ride who had dropped him off had left. So he had to flag down someone else to take him back to the house, which was locked. So he had to, like, pound on the windows, wake somebody up, get his bib and chip, go back to the...
She's talking about timing chip.
Yeah, back to the buses to see if he could, you know, get to the top. Well, it was only the half marathon buses which were running at this point.
You know, you get halfway up.
So he got halfway up, and so then he had to connive a volunteer who was, you know, checking aid stations to take him all the way to the top. So in his case, it was necessary.
Now, if that was you, would you have been outgoing enough to connive all the people to take you all the way?
I don't know. I probably would have cried. My Garmin's dead. I missed the bus.
Come back to the hotel.
I would have made you drive me to the top.
Yeah, I would have done it.
I know you would have. So, you know, another guy that was up there was a man named Daryl Beardall, and he was running the marathon for the 41st time. I think he's in his 70s. And his personal best of the race was 2 hours and 22 minutes. But he said, oh, no, I'll probably finish in around 5 hours and 30 minutes this time. He was pretty laid back about it. But I thought, you know, it was really cool. Someone from the area who was really dedicated to the race to run it that many times.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I think all in all, there was around 250 people who ran the full marathon. So probably there was double the amount with the half. And then the 10K was the most popular race of the day. So
250 people, a small group of dedicated runners willing to sit on the mountain for an hour and a half at 3 o'clock in the morning.
That's right. So the race started at 5:30, and instantly the course started winding downhill. And it was semi-dark for the first 3 miles. There was a bright moon out, so it wasn't like pitch black.
I'm glad they organized it so the moon would be bright.
Exactly. That was very good on their part. And I was still a little bit worried about stepping in a pothole, but I just tried to keep myself with the rest of the pack and hope for the best. And I really did try to take it pretty slowly the first 6 miles. But going downhill, it's hard to run without putting on that braking motion. You know, you don't want to beat your legs up by constantly braking.
Right.
But then you don't want to get ahead of yourself and...
And you had no idea how...
energy.
You had no idea how fast you were going because...
I wasn't wearing my watch, so I'm just kind of like thinking... They did have a couple pacing groups, but, you know, in the first 3 miles of the race, it's not very accurate anyway, mm-hmm. At least the pacing group. So I'm just like, well, I'm just going to go according to how I feel, and started getting down the mountain. And it started getting light fairly quickly, and it was really beautiful. Just Immigration Pass and mountains, trees, rivers, the whole nine yards. I think this is definitely one of the most scenic races that I've run. So
wow.
It was definitely worth it for that part. And I could really feel the effects of the elevation early on, and I started to get a really sharp headache in my temples, which I never really get headaches, so that was unusual. And I thought, well, maybe I'm pushing myself too hard, so I gladly walked the hills between miles 6 and 8. It was, you know, a big sacrifice on my part, but
yeah,
didn't want my headache to get worse. And I also tried to drink extra fluid at the aid stations to counter the effects of the dryness and the altitude. And they were about every 2 to 3 miles apart, and they had water and sports drink. But there was only usually, you know, 2, maybe 3 volunteers at each aid station. So, you know, it was fairly small. I heard later they had trouble getting volunteers to man all the aid stations. So, but, I mean, it worked. I carried a handheld water bottle with me because I knew that I would probably be getting more thirsty. And so at every one, I would just fill my bottle, take a drink, and keep going. And it was just a really beautiful run. I felt like the middle miles of the race passed pretty quickly, although my toes were kind of starting to feel the effects of going downhill so much. Around mile 14, I noticed that my nose was running a lot more than usual. I have exercise-induced rhinitis, which is very common. And I went to wipe my nose with my hand, and I noticed I had a bloody nose. So I'm like, oh no. I tried to hold pressure on it with my fingers while I'm running, which is not an easy task, by the way. Apparently that I can't do more than one thing at a time. And, of course, this is when I come upon one of the few race photographers. Mm-hmm. So I'm, like, trying to look in the other direction, like, so he won't take my picture. I have this bloody nose. And, fortunately, the volunteer at the next aid station had some tissues, and I was able to clean up my face and wad part of the Kleenex up my nose to stop the bleeding.
But that would make for a good picture.
I know. I was like, who cares about dignity when you're running a marathon, you know? But I had never had a bloody nose during a marathon before either, so.
What brought it on? The dryness, the elevation?
I would say it was probably the elevation, the dryness, the fact that I was exerting myself.
I think it was digital insertion.
What? You think I picked my nose?
I'm just kidding.
I may have been guilty of that in the past, but this was not. Around mile 16, we started to come into the outskirts of Salt Lake City, and I thought the race was really well controlled, the course was well marked, and there was police at the intersections. And it was also interesting, while we were running down the mountain, there were just dozens of cyclists who were pedaling up the mountain. Cycling seems to be a really big sport in that area. And then, you know, a few miles later, they were like whizzing past us. So it was kind of interesting. I definitely don't like to pedal uphill. I think I'd rather run uphill than ride uphill. But the downhill is more fun.
So tell us about the challenge of running downhill for so long. How many miles total you think was actually downhill?
I would say at least 16 miles was downhill.
Wow.
And it was very challenging. I was definitely not prepared for how challenging it would have been. Even though you read about it, so you know mentally, until you experience it physically, it's like definitely a different ball game.
Now, when you say downhill, is it like a noticeably downhill or just a real slight grade?
The first 6 miles was very noticeably downhill, and then it varied after that.
Mm-hmm.
But other than the uphills, about mile 6 through 8, I would say it was either somewhat flat, a little bit downhill, or steep downhill. I don't know the exact grades of the road at each point.
After having done this now, would you rather run 16 miles uphill or 16 miles down?
I think a mixture of up and down is nice.
I didn't give you that option.
Sorry. See, please. you know, obviously, when you're just running uphill with no end in sight, it gets pretty demoralizing as well.
Seems like you're going to be incredibly sore either option.
Yeah. And, I mean, when I was in Missoula, my proximal hamstring was really hurting. And there was a few uphills in that section. So running downhill didn't hurt my hamstring at all, which was nice. But, man, my quads, my toes were really taking a beating.
Yeah.
So it was...
Did you lose any toenails?
I've got some bruised ones, so only time will tell. I usually keep my toenails painted either purple or green or blue, so I can't really tell what my toenails look like underneath that. And then all of a sudden, one will fall off. I'm like, oh, whoops. I was thinking the temperature would get pretty warm as we came into Salt Lake, but there was a nice cloud cover and breeze, and so it really didn't feel warmer than the 70s, so that was a relief. And we got closer to town. There was a lot of people out to celebrate Pioneer Day, and they have what's called the Days of 47 Parade. And so there weren't really any marathon spectators to speak of. Most people were kind of just hanging around waiting to go to the parade and things like that. So this wasn't a marathon to run if you really feel like you need a lot of support and encouragement.
Well, that'd be really strange with thousands of people out on the streets. So they're there as spectators, but just not to watch runners.
Yeah, they're just basically kind of milling around ignoring you.
Yeah.
We actually ran along the parade course as the parade is going on for about a quarter mile.
Huh.
So I'm like running along and there's like, you know, people dressed as pioneers like plodding along the middle street with their horses and their wagons.
Wow.
But the people are like, you know, craning their necks to see around you to see the, you know, the floats and everything.
Next time you should bring candy and throw.
I know, I think it would have been...
Yeah, that is funny.
It was a different experience.
Because you're used to all these spectators cheering you on at the finish line. And here's a race where they're just indifferent, you know?
Right. Which, I mean, the race says, you know, imagine 10,000 spectators cheering for you as you run along, you know, this parade course. I'm thinking, maybe they cheered for the 10K runners, but they had no cheers left for the slow marathoners.
Yeah, they just let you guys were slow 10K. You're like, hey, they don't even deserve to be clapped.
I don't know. It was pretty funny. So as we cut off the parade course, and then we went to the finishing area, which was in Liberty Park. And then there were people around there who were focused on the race, and there was some cheering that went on there. So all was not lost. But so I ended up finishing in 4 hours, 21 minutes, and 16 seconds, which was a full minute faster than Missoula. Must have been all those downhills.
It's an exact minute
faster. It was. It was really...
strange.
Uncanny, definitely. So after the race, I went through the finishing area, and after finding there was not much food to speak of, I went to find the buses that would take me back to the stadium where I'd parked the car, and that proved to be a challenge, too. There was tons of buses parked around, but they were all for band members who were performing in the parade.
Huh.
So that was a little bit different. It wasn't like they had clearly buses for runners, buses for band members.
You just had to ask the bus driver?
Yeah, and they're like... no, this is for band members only. And we're like stumbling around trying to find the buses. We just want to sit on a bus. Finally, we found the buses and got on board. And so, continuing the theme of directionally challenged bus drivers, this bus driver took us like 20 minutes out of the way to the complete wrong place.
Oh, man.
So everyone's like, oh, hey, this is not the place.
You know? You do a 12-point turn on a precipice?
Fortunately not. It's just all roads at this point. But anyway, got back to the stadium in our car. And it was also a challenge to get back to the hotel because there were so many roads closed for the marathon and for the parade. I got to take a nice long detour through several scenic areas of Salt Lake and got back to the hotel and took a shower and packed up our stuff and realized our honey bucket had tipped over. Another small crisis.
Yeah, what she's talking about is we bought a 5-gallon bucket of honey in Montana because Angie and her mom think that the purest honey is from Montana.
We're honey snobs.
So we have to buy a 5-gallon bucket every time we're there. Which is cool, but it tipped over in the back of the car while you were coming back from...
I was careening around Salt Lake.
Yeah. When you come back from the marathon, it tipped over. So it was a huge mess. Not all 5 gallons spilled out, but probably a half a gallon.
And honey has a way of just getting everywhere and clinging to everything.
Actually, if you want to see a picture of it and read Angie's full race report from the Deseret News Classic, go over to our website. She put up a blog post with pictures, and you can see everything she's talking about.
Including the honey spill.
So once we got on the road, we stopped for lunch at an Italian place, because you deserved it right after...
Yes, I did.
Running so far.
Running that and the horrible pizza the night before.
And then we journeyed on into Colorado and stayed there that night. Tell me about how your body felt. How sore were you after running so far downhill?
Well, it didn't really kick in, obviously, till the next day.
Right.
And, yeah, I have not been this sore after a marathon since my first, I think. Mm. I felt like I'd been run over by a bus. It was like, you know, sitting down on the toilet, you, like, needed the rails to, like, lower yourself down, like, standing up. And it didn't help that we'd gotten in the car and driven several hours after the race. And then we spent basically the next 2 days in the car, like, 10 and 11-hour days.
Yeah, to get back to Missouri.
So it wasn't exactly ideal race recovery.
And so you didn't take an ice bath?
I didn't take an ice bath. I committed all the cardinal sins, and I paid for it by hobbling around for 3 days. So yeah, I was very sore, but I learned some good lessons, and I hope to share them with you so you can avoid my pain.
All right, so let's get into those valuable, painful lessons that Angie learned. How to train for a downhill marathon, maybe even how to recover from one.
Right. Yeah, if you've never run a long race that's primarily downhill, you're probably thinking, what's all the fuss about? You know, how hard can it be to let gravity just pull you along for the ride? But most people underestimate, I know I did, how running downhill can zap your muscle strength and lead to things like cramping, heavy legs, sore feet, blisters, lost toenails, and post-race soreness. One reason why running downhill is so difficult is that it requires the muscles to repeatedly lengthen, causing microscopic tears in the muscle fibers. It also generates more force than when you're running flat or even uphill. You also may underestimate your pace, and the faster you move, the harder your foot strikes the ground, which results in more pounding on your body. According to Irene Davis, PhD, who is the director of the Running Injury Clinic at the University of Delaware, the body absorbs a bigger impact with each foot strike, leaving you at risk for iliotibial band syndrome and other injuries. It's also easy to overstride, which will make you land harder, wear your muscles out more quickly, and possibly lead to other injuries. The quadricep muscles, as well as the tendons and ligaments in the ankles, knees, hips, and lower back, can take a beating. I think after this marathon, the only muscles that weren't sore for me were my glutes and my hamstrings. So I definitely found that to be true. I mean, I was sore. My ankles were sore.
Wow.
My feet were sore. It was definitely the whole package.
Your throat was sore?
No. So if you've been running for any length of time, you probably know that you should be running hills for strength and speed gains. But there's also evidence that running downhill can improve speed and foot turnover. The key is to incorporate them into your training before a big event, not afterward like I did. That way you'll tolerate the downhill running better and you'll recover more quickly. There's some marathons that offer lots of downhills besides the Deseret News Classic, and these include St. George in Utah, the Biz Johnson Trail in California, California International, and Steamtown in Pennsylvania all have some downhill sections. And so you may mistakenly think that a downhill course is going to guarantee you a PR, but that may not necessarily be the truth if you're not well trained for the course. So here are some tips for training on downhills to run your next downhill marathon wisely. And you may be thinking, well, I can't implement the upcoming tips because I don't have any hills to train on. And you're not alone. We don't really have many hills around here either. I did get some tips recently from a coaching client named Beth who lives in Florida. She's training for the upcoming Pikes Peak Ascent, which is 13.1 miles up Pikes Peak. And she gave me some really good tips on how to find inclines and declines. I thought I would share real quick before I got into the tips here. She says, I started running because I wanted to run uphill. There's usually a good view from a hilltop. I found several ways to replicate the incline outside of the treadmill and look forward to doing these the most. And she says, bridges is number one. I live by the water and have a great downtown run that includes several. I will do repeats of the larger bridge. So maybe you've never thought about, you know, an interstate overpass or a bridge, but they can be a nice incline and decline for you to train on. Number two, parking garages. I live close to a hospital, she said. The surface is smooth. I can leave my water up top. It works well for up and downhill training. I also use the stairs for supersets. So parking garage, possibly in a hospital. That way, if you have any injuries, you're right there, you know? Number three, stairs. The Stairmaster, buildings, bleachers, just stepping. Last year before hiking in the Sierra Nevada, she said, I spent lots of time on the stairs and had no problem covering 80 miles in the trip. I was never sore. Stairs gave me powerful hip flexors. And the final tip I'd never heard about, she says, ladders. She's like, so, these are probably not super popular. I have a tall ladder leaned against my house. I will climb up and down. It is strengthening for so many small parts. So, yeah, if you've never thought of ladder training, that might be a good option. My thought was to lean the ladder against the hospital in case of a fall that way. But I thought those were some good tips because, you know, for many of us, we're hill challenged. And if you're not challenged to find hills, embrace them, be thankful for them, and use them often.
Don't you think like some good lower body weight training will kind of accomplish the same thing?
Strength training is also excellent. It won't accomplish exactly the same thing, but it will be helpful. The more lower body strength you have, the better. Even plyometrics is very good for strengthening the lower body and getting your body used to some of the impact.
Plyometrics is like jump training, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly. So here are my tips for training on downhills. The first one is to prepare your body. Develop good core strength before and during your marathon training. One of the best exercises to strengthen your core are planks. Specific exercises to prepare the legs are also important. Things like lunges, squats that we talked about, strength training, plyometric work will also help you prepare for the pounding. So get your body in shape and you'll have a better success with running downhill. The second tip is to evaluate your shoes. For a downhill half or full marathon, you might want to shoe with more forefoot cushioning to help offset the impact. So you may not want to do downhill marathon in, you know, your most minimal trainers, unless you've practiced that way. Just you're getting a lot of pounding and it can be very painful. Also make sure that your shoe isn't too small so that your toes aren't slamming against the front of your shoes. So it can be helpful to buy your shoes in like a half size bigger, just so you have some extra toe room. Also trim your toenails carefully and make sure they aren't too long. Wear comfortable socks that don't have an annoying toe seam, because as your foot slides forward in your shoe, it's going to, you know, make you rub against it and it'll be more annoying. That's one of the things I noticed, is that my toe seam in my sock just bothered me a lot. So that was, you know, one of those minor irritants that you think,
Who would have thought?
Toe seam is bothering me.
You sound like one of our kids.
I know.
Sock problems all the time.
I did not cry and I did not whine about it, so there's the difference. The third tip is to watch your running form. It's natural when you're on downhills to want to lean back and use a braking motion. To correct this and the tendency to overstride, be sure to lean slightly downhill, which sounds counterproductive, but you also want to shorten your stride and focus on quick foot turnover. Make sure you're landing lightly and keep your shoulders, hips, and feet aligned. Work on stepping down for your next step instead of stepping out, which will also help decrease your overstriding. So just kind of let your foot fall down instead of reaching out with it, and that will help you keep your cadence really short and quick and will prevent you from overstriding there. Joe McConkie of the Boston Running Center says that it should almost feel like controlled falling to allow for more natural foot placement while keeping forward momentum. So form is more important than speed at first when you're running downhill. Because obviously if your form is bad, you get too much speed going, there's going to be a problem, maybe a face plant or something.
I think I can visualize what you're trying to say. And I try to be aware of my form when I'm running uphill or down. And so you're saying you don't want to lean back because that creates a braking motion.
Exactly.
It's going to wear your muscles out. You don't want to lean forward too much, obviously, because then you'll be going too fast.
Or your head over heels, yeah.
So slightly lean forward.
Mm-hmm.
And just try to focus on keeping your steps shorter, not stretching out when you stride.
Exactly. Yeah, like a controlled fall, basically. Or maybe a controlled lean is better.
Yeah, I'll have to give that a try.
The third tip is to start gradually. It's probably best not to start your downhill training with a downhill marathon like I just did. Instead, start with a short, gradual slope of about 2 to 3% grade, and then move on to steeper, longer descents once you've mastered the easier ones. It's also best to start with softer surfaces like grass or dirt before tackling the roads. Approximately half of your long run should be done on the course that mimics your key race. So try to keep that in mind if you've got a specific downhill race or marathon coming up. The fifth tip is to practice your pace. Train so that you know what your goal race pace feels like on downhills, flat terrain, and uphills. This is going to help you keep an even pace throughout the race. Because running downhill isn't as hard aerobically, you'll need to avoid the natural inclination to go all out, trying to bank lots of time for later on. While training, your best bet is to simulate the race course that you'll be running. So get to know what your race pace feels like on downhills, on flat, on uphill, because your body's going to be working differently on each surface. The sixth tip is to do specific downhill workouts. Because your body adapts to the usual training you do, it's important to give it a challenge occasionally. Running uphill will strengthen the back part of your legs, like the hamstrings, glutes, calves, and the plantar fascia, while running downhill will work on the front part of your leg for balanced strength. So here are some specific downhill workouts that you can implement. With any of these, make sure that you warm up by running easy on flat ground for about 10 minutes before attempting any of them so that you don't have a higher chance of injury. So here's three different workouts that you can try to build up your downhill strength. The first one is called 4x4s. What you're going to do after you warm up is run 4 minutes downhill slightly faster than your goal race pace, then run 4 minutes on flat ground, then either jog slowly or walk back up the hill and repeat the sequence of 4 minutes downhill, 4 minutes flat, and then walking or jogging uphill 4 to 6 times.
Seems like you'd have to have a particular terrain where there's going to be 4 minutes worth of downhill and 4 minutes worth of flat right there.
Right. There's some places where there's like the monster hill, you know, that's going to provide you with enough downhills to be able to do workout of that length.
It seems like it had to be a pretty long hill, though, for 4 minutes worth, don't you think?
It depends on how quickly you run, but yeah, it would be a long hill.
It's like a half a mile hill, maybe.
Mm-hmm. There are hills like that, you know, even though we don't have any in Southeast Missouri.
I haven't seen one for a long time.
I know, neither have I. The second workout is called hill repeats. So this may be a little bit more doable if you have shorter hills. Make sure you warm up and then run uphill for 60 to 120 seconds. So that's 1 to 2 minutes, then run easy for 30 seconds, then turn around, run downhill for 60 to 90 seconds at race pace, run 60 seconds on flat ground at race pace, and repeat the sequence 3 to 6 times. So basically, after warming up, you're going to run your uphill for a longer stretch, do easy flat, run downhill at race pace, and then run flat again and repeat the sequence.
Got it.
Great. The third one is called up and down. You're going to want to run a gradual downhill for 2 miles at race pace. So you're going to need a pretty good hill for this one as well. Run 2 miles uphill at a steady pace and take walk breaks as needed. Then run downhill for 2 miles at race pace. And then finish with a 1 mile flat and easy. So, you know, it depends on the type of hills you have. You can also do this type of workout if you have, you know, a course with rolling hills. So basically you're going to be getting your ups, your downs, your flats. And that works pretty well. And we'll post all of these workouts on our blog because I know sometimes if you're like me, you can't take in much information audibly without seeing it written down.
Yes, we'll have it all neat and tidy for you over there.
That's all right.
And you can leave a comment, just not a spammy comment.
The last tip on downhill training is all about recovery. Make sure that you treat downhill training like a hard workout. Use a recovery drink or an easily digestible carb-protein combination within the first 60 minutes. Also take an ice bath within the first 3 hours and then slip on some compression socks. If you have delayed onset muscle soreness, consider using a warm Epsom salt bath, which will help draw out some of the lactic acid.
So you want to take a cold bath or a hot bath? This is confusing.
Take a cold bath the first day, or you know, specifically in the first 3 hours. The next day, when the delayed muscle onset soreness comes on, take the warm baths with Epsom salt.
That'll
help relax your muscles. Be sure to move around and avoid taking long trips requiring lots of sitting if you can help it.
Yeah.
So take 2 to 3 days for easy running or light cross training after you do a downhill session. And especially if you're really sore, don't try to do another hard workout right away. Also, don't do any downhill training in the 2 weeks before a key race because you don't want to be sore. You want to give your muscles time to recover and be fresh and strong for your key race.
So, Angie, I know the Deseret News Marathon was kind of a last-minute choice that we made, and I didn't get to run it because I was with the kids in the hotel room in
sleeping.
Bed. Yeah. I didn't envy you when your alarm clock went off at 2 in the morning.
I don't think you even heard it.
Maybe I didn't. I can't remember. Overall, did you have a good time? Did you enjoy that race?
I did have a good time.
Would you do it again?
I would do it again if there wasn't, you know, another marathon. I like to do new races.
Yeah, I understand.
So, but yeah, I mean, obviously it was painful, especially afterward, and the toe pounding during it, but it had more in its favor than against it. So, yeah, I would recommend it. I would just recommend that you at least train on part of the course or get ready for downhills before you do it, and you'll have a much more awesome and faster experience than I did.
How many days did it take for the soreness to wear off?
Let's see. I think by day 4, I was walking normally.
And then how soon after it did you run again?
I ran 3 days afterward, and it actually kind of helped shake out some of the stiffness and the soreness.
Okay.
Not, you know, it wasn't a hard run or anything. It was just kind of a nice little 4-mile jaunt.
Those are my favorite kind of jaunts. Well, now it's time for this episode's quick tip, and this is actually an idea that I had because I was out for a run yesterday. I checked the sky. You know, it was kind of overcast. There was a chance it might rain, but I just wanted to run. Wanted to go on a long run, maybe, you know, about a 2-hour run. So I had my hydration pack, had my iPod. I was going to listen to some podcasts, and I just went for it. And I got about 3 miles out, and it started just dumping rain on me. Luckily, I had my hat on, so the visor of my hat kept the water out of my eyes and kept my glasses from getting all covered in water. I had my phone and I had my iPod. I was worried about water getting in there and ruining them, you know. Even though they were zipped up in my hydration pack, I just didn't know how waterproof it was. So I decided to turn around and come back. And my long run turned into a tempo run. And I got back and you like kind of looked at me like, "You're back already?" So then I came around the corner, you saw how drenched I was.
Yes.
And you understood why.
Drowned
I came back.
Rat came to mind.
So my shoes are still wet. And what I did was, tell me if this was smart. I stuffed newspaper into each shoe, which draws out the moisture. So that's what I've done with my soaking wet shoes. But the quick tip is about, what do you do with your soaking wet shoes?
And sometimes in the summer, when you run, if you're like me, you'll sweat so much that your shoes will come back soggy, like squish, squish at every step.
That's never happened to me.
Okay, well, I'm a heavy sweater.
You need to go to the doctor.
I know. I'm abnormally normal, so there. Anyway, the important thing is to deal with your shoes right away. I like to take out the insole and have it dry separately.
Oh,
then there's more
do.
Airflow through the shoe. And then put your lightly wadded newspaper into the shoe itself. It will help absorb, draw out moisture. 24 hours of that and your shoes are fairly dry, in my experience. What you don't want to do is to put the shoes in your dryer or put them next to a radiator because that can crack or dry out the rubber or the leather.
Same thing with leaving them outside in the sun.
Yeah, I mean, the sun's kind of negotiable, but a neighborhood dog may drag one away. So, in a pinch, you can use a hair dryer like on a cool or warm setting just aimed at the inside of your shoe, but you don't want to use the hot setting because that could be damaging as well. And ideally, you should have 2 pairs of running shoes so that you can rotate them out. One pair is, you know, soggy or something happened to them. You can use the other pair in the meantime.
So there you go. Just a quick tip about what to do and what not to do with your soaking wet shoes. If you'd like more information on running and marathon training, visit us at marathontrainingacademy.com. And when you're there, you can download a free audio gift called The 7 Pillars of Successful Marathon Training. And you can also see how to become a member of the Academy and get premium content that'll help you prepare for a marathon and or half marathon. Thank you for listening to this episode. We want you to know you do have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Well on my way, well on my way. Oh, wait.